Welcome to Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show. This episode of Fragmented is brought to you by Rollbar. Have you ever been in the situation where your application reports an error to your error provider, and then the API reports an error to its error provider, and you're trying to trace them across different platforms to try to figure out what happened? As you can imagine, it's a real pain in the butt. It really sucks to try to dig through all those different logs just to debug issues. With Rollbar, you get a centralized location of where you can put all of your errors for both your application and your endpoint, so you can try to fix these issues faster and much easier. Works great with all the major languages and frameworks. I have used it, for example, with Node.js, and a couple of clients of mine have actually used it for their applications as well.
Some of their biggest clients include Heroku, Twilio, Kayak, Zendesk, Twitch, and Instacart. We use Rollbar at Instacart, and it's super critical to our workflow. The integration with services like PagerDuty makes sure that if you're on call, we hear about production issues even before customers and can fix them right away. It's a big reason we have so many happy customers. As part of a special offer for our listeners, they're giving their Bootstrap plan free for 90 days. All you have to do is go to rollbar.com/fragmented. Sign up for their free offer and let them know you came from us. With Rollbar, you put errors in their place. Thanks again to Rollbar for sponsoring the show.
So, Kaushik, I've been trying to get my apps, been trying to make them look a little bit better, like, you know, material and so forth. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done anything like this before? And do you know anyone that might be able to help us out here?
Oh, sure. So we've actually never touched on the topic of material design from the developer's point of view. So I thought it would make sense because we both are definitely curious about material design. And I'm sure both of us have like dabbled with it at the levels that we need to. But we thought, let's really deep dive into this. And for that, we got our mutual friend of the show and material design master, Mike Wolfson. So without any further ado, let's get Mike on. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Mike, can you explain a little bit about who you are and maybe your background in software development and, you know, in particular, Android?
Sure. Well, like most current Android developers, I started in the world doing Java development, enterprise Java development. And the company I was working at needed a Android app back in the day. And I had been dabbling and actually created a app in the Play Store just to learn about Android. So I was able to kind of turn my hobby into a career. And this was right when Android was getting started. And I kind of saw the writing on the wall that Android's going to be awesome and big. And so I kind of dedicated my career to learning and doing Android.
Awesome. So where exactly are you located? Are you in the States? Are you overseas? Where are you at?
Well, as you know, as well as I do, I live in Phoenix, Arizona. I am now the top Android developer in Phoenix. I used to be the second best, but I ran the top. I ran the top guy out of town. So that's Don. Don moved away from Phoenix. So I am a. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I am a freelance guy. So I do general different things for a lot of different companies. Right now, I am working for a company called The Medical Memory. They are a startup in Phoenix, and we are creating a framework to allow physicians to record video interactions with their patients, and then the patients can, you know, review them later and view them offline. So that's what I'm working on now, but I'm constantly on the hunt for the next contract and interested in doing, you know, design and design-focused development. One last thing that's kind of worth noting is I am a Google developer expert, as you are, Don. And so it allows me to kind of leverage my passion for Android and kind of help the community. So that's kind of a really important part of my identity.
Definitely.
So we have a lot to talk about today. So let's hop in right into the discussion. Let's start off like with the very basics. What exactly is material design? And I know there's a material design specs that's laid out. Let's just try to give a quick intro into what this whole thing is about.
Sure. So I think it's really great context to kind of talk about what material design is. So material design is a design language that Google created. So it's both a design language to describe how, you know, user interfaces should look and feel. And then it's also a specification that defines exactly how you're supposed to accomplish these various things. So there is a really great document at design.google.com. That's kind of like Google's main landing page for this stuff. And there's on that page is something called the material design specification. Inside of that is more information than you could ever hope to learn about, interaction guidelines and style guidelines, animation, layout, components. But the important thing is the design spec is just a spec. It just tells you what you're supposed to do. It doesn't have any information about how you're actually supposed to accomplish that. So the design spec includes all sorts of fancy animations and all sorts of really interesting language about paper morphing into other paper, things like that. However, to actually develop this stuff is incredibly or can be incredibly difficult. But I think that's what we're here to talk about is how the second half of this equation, and that's kind of the support libraries, are designed to kind of work within the specification. And, you know, help us get there.
So now material design is a spec. I guess the big thing is why, you know, as developers that we are, why should we care about that? Isn't it a designer's job? And also, I guess if we were to flip that on its head, why would designers care about this spec in general?
Okay. So there's kind of a few different reasons that we care. And I think designers and developers should care for these same reasons. So the first one is creating apps that work on Android, and we want to make sure that they fit on Android, meaning the app itself has the same sort of dimensions and layouts and parameters as every other app on the phone. That means when you're going between apps and different functionality, the app itself feels like it is designed to fit within the Android framework. So, it's amazing how that fit really kind of subconsciously affects the user experience. By just having different margins or button sizes or different icons, it really takes the user out of the Android experience, right? And the most important thing is we're creating Android apps that live within the Android ecosystem. So really important that we're meeting the fit and finish that Android has specified for us.
That's a very subtle point that you mentioned, and it's so true. I was having a talk with a designer some time back, and just these small things, you may think it's not really going to lead to anything different, like just having the margins and padding, because the concern is always, well, how do you add character to your application? You don't want it to look like a stock material design app, because then, like, you know, if you're a company or if you're building this new app, you want it to be memorable in some ways, right? But you can still adhere to the spec and have this. And those small things that you mentioned is such a fantastic point. Like just keeping the margin, like the key line, the padding, all just having all that, it makes you feel like you're a member of the ecosystem.
Yeah. And actually, just to kind of piggyback on your point, so we want to make sure that our apps fit and look right. Okay. And so that's kind of the general stuff that we talked about, sizing and dimensions. But we also want to kind of create some unique opportunities that make our app kind of different and not, like you said, just kind of vanilla material. So what the thing is, you want to concentrate on creating those unique UI experiences in the places that it counts. So you don't mess with the dimensions and padding and stuff like that, because that doesn't, it may make your app look unique and different, but not in a good way, right? Where you want to concentrate is on specific animations or, user icons, you know, app-specific icons, things that you can really differentiate your app on a very important level, but not in the way that your app just doesn't feel right.
You know, the app that, and we actually interviewed one of the developers that did this app, but the app that always rings total material but done very well in my mind is the Pocket Cast app. I mean, what do you think about that?
You know, I was just looking at that yesterday. One of our mutual friends was showing it to me. And I think it's great, right? They use a lot of, they use the collapsible app bar and they use activity view transitions, I noticed. But it feels like a material app and it feels like a Android app, yet they take the opportunities to create some really nice UI flourishes in important places.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's one of those things, like when it first came out, they had these small little animations. And I remember a talk that you gave at the Phoenix Android group, And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you said something like you shouldn't have animations unless there's a user interaction. Is there something like that that you had said?
So that's interesting. This is actually a key point of the material design spec. And that is, and I'm holding up my fingers in quotes, the user drives interactions, end quote. So material design is, motion is one of the key criteria or important characteristics of material design. And the whole kind of factor of it is that the user drives that motion to happen. So you see this in ripple effects or when, you know, buttons raise to touch your finger, as they call it. All these different motion effects are important part of material, but they don't happen superfluously or just kind of for the sake of, you know, things flashing or things moving. They happen when the user causes some action. And then those motion effects themselves are actually useful and key feedback to the user. So the user does something, they see some motion that it reinforces what they did is correct and fun and delightful.
I learned a lot from just that simple tip, because for the, you know, last many years, I would create animations in my app and like, oh, that's a cool animation. Let me throw it all over the place. You know, and it was just like this, you know, it's like back in the early 2000s when the gradients and page flips were the thing in graphic design. It's like animations are that way in Android. And then once I heard that exact statement of that you just, you know, recap there, I question myself every time I want to create an animation for something. I think I'm like, all right, is this like a user initiated action? Is it going to add anything to the user experience? Is it going to look like a nice polish? And if the answer is usually no, at that point, I don't include it.
Of course, animations can be problematic for memory and for, you know, they're difficult to develop and things too. So, you know, concentrate on doing them when they matter most.
The other huge advantage as developers, especially with these things, is sometimes it's hard. Personally, as a developer, sometimes it's hard for me. Well, should this value be 16 dB? Should it be 12 dB? Should it be a large font? Should it be a small font? Like, these decisions are just like alleviated, right? Having this spec basically makes it easy. Sometimes I don't want to think about these things. I want someone to have put a lot of thought into this and come up with the perfect guideline or styles, and I can just go look and refer to them. And that's also one huge benefit I've found with like the Google design guidelines. Sometimes even designers come back, because like we have designers who crisscross between different platforms, and when they come back and say, oh yeah, what is that value, like how should this be, just having those guidelines is so convenient, because then it also makes you feel that, oh yeah, this is how it ideally should be, and this is where we can take inspiration from. I don't have to like go searching, spend time thinking about it. It's just there for us to use, right?
Wow, super key important point. The one thing that I find really empowering about these specifications is it eliminates kind of all the nuances that the designers dealt with previously. So I've spent a lot of time dealing specifically with designers, and forever, forever I would get, you know, a spec for a particular screen that has unique DPs for every margin, generally defined in pixels, right? Because they're coming from an iOS world, generally not compatible with what, you know, they don't have 16 DP specified. They have 13 on this screen or 12 on this screen, etc. So the really powerful thing about the design spec is that those things are now fixed. So I don't care what the designer gives me, because I'm basically going to ignore those. I know that the design spec says 16 dp is the side margin, and that's it. So it really disintermediates the designer from doing the tedious mocking per screen that they're used to doing on iOS, and that we don't really want to embrace on Android, right? Because we want to create these templates that are responsive and that are generic and not specific per screen. Just kind of one other nuance. So I mentioned I spoke, you know, I've dealt with designers forever. Basically, I just ignore the stuff that they send me regarding dimensions and stuff. And to be clear, no one has ever come back and said, hey, dude, I specified 13 pixels and this is clearly not 13 pixels. Go fix it. They never have noticed. So
would you say material design is based on some, I mean, as I've seen in the spec, it looks like it's based on some type of grid system. And can you talk maybe a little bit about what maybe that the generic grid system is that we need to keep in our head? Like, is there any dimensions that we should kind of be aware of, and that every developer should just kind of know off the top of their head?
Yeah, so that's pretty simple. Is the new material design spec creates a grid system where one grid point is equal to 8 dp. So now instead of saying side margins are 16 dp, they're really two grid points. And so all of the material design specs are based on these 8 dp grids. Basically, it's just kind of a little bit of an abstraction from, you know, 8 to, you know, 8 to 1. In my, I have a sample material design app. I actually just abstract each of those grid points into dimensions. Grid 1 is equal to 8 dp. Grid 2 is equal to 16 dp.
And so as I understand the way material design works, so as developers, when we dive in, right, there's also this concept of like different primary or important colors. For example, you have color primary, you have color accent, color primary dark. So can you touch a little on like what all these colors are about?
Sure. So this is important to the material design spec. They've created a color palette that each app is supposed to use. So you're supposed to pick a primary color, which is your branding color, then a secondary color, which will be used for different kind of secondary, I don't want to use accents, but secondary color. And then a third, which is an accent color, which is very different from your two primary colors. So your primary color is, let's say, green. You pick a primary secondary, a primary dark color that's just another shade of green, two shades darker. And then your accent would be something pink or something very different. So the important thing is, once you start using the material design, the apps, app compat libraries, and you've defined these colors within your styles, the system itself will start to apply these colors universally throughout your app and even the system. So certain system, the system toolbar will be changed on M devices, or I think L devices actually. So it allows you to create these three branding colors that define your, you know, brand very specifically, and then the system itself actually applies these universally. So it's a really powerful thing because you're able to, you know, choose these colors, and then the system itself applies them everywhere. And you know, it's a really great way to get your brand kind of universal throughout your app.
I mean, it makes so much sense. And all these, obviously, just adding those primary colors sort of cascade the whole theme adhering to the guidelines. So like all the ripple effects, all those things, they just like use the right sort of color. They pick the right color from there.
And the awesome thing is you don't have to do that manually because, before App Compat, you basically had to apply your color, theme every single
all your views, right?
View that you have on your screen.
Oh, geez, yeah.
That was painful.
You asked me why we care about this and why we want to do this. One of my slides in a presentation I give is because I want to be lazy.
Laziness, always the solution, man. I'm all with you there.
Yes.
So I just want to address kind of the colors, and the spec itself defines 16 different color palettes. So
16. Oh, okay. Wow.
Wow.
I think it's maybe 12 or 16, where they have a green palette, a blue palette, a dark blue, etc. And then there's 10 different shades in each of those color specifications. Material design spec actually wants you to use those colors predominantly. So they're asking that you stick to that color palette predominantly.
Oh, interesting. That is also something that I didn't probably catch. Like I was like, oh, those are nice and pretty colors. I'll use them if I need to. But
look at the pinks.
I should use that for my t-shirt. The other thing, I know there are like a whole bunch of other specific colors. For example, we talked about color primary, right? There's color control normal, color control activated, color control highlight, color button normal. So I think in most how-tos and guidelines that we see online, at least in the tutorials, they specify the main ones, color primary, primary dark, and accent, right? But actually what happens is like you can, for the same reasons, if you want a little more control over how these colors show up, then basically you can specify a whole bunch of them. I'll try to add a link in the show notes to like some of these handy diagrams that at least I use and like some of the references that I use for this. For example, when I started out, I had no clue. But if you specify your primary dark, etc., so the status bar, that is like the top system bar, is color usually picks color primary dark. Then your toolbar or your action bars usually take color primary. And then like the text is text color primary, and then there's a window background. Like I'll add a link. I usually use this for, it's pretty helpful. So there, like just for so people are aware, there's like this, there's a huge number of these very specific colors that you can sort of control. It's like a layer lower than you directly styling your components with that color.
Now, in a lot of applications that I've worked with, I've had the luxury or pain of working with images a lot. And sometimes those images can have a drastic effect on the UI. For example, if my UI, let's say it's like green, and then I load up an image and the image is like full of like blue colors and or like purples, and it just doesn't look right. Is there anything in the material design specification or maybe even in the libraries that can help us with working with various images so we can maybe tint or change our application to match that? I feel like I've seen that in some applications.
Yeah, so you're talking about something called the palette library. And what this does is this allows you to give the method the image that you're looking for, and it actually will look into that image and pull out a color palette that provides complementary colors and then contrasting colors to that. So for instance, you send in a image that is predominantly blue, it will send you back a palette that includes, you know, blue and different highlights. And then also one of those colors it sends back is would be white, a contrasting color that you could, you know, set your title to make sure that it is always, you know, contrasting against that image.
Oh, wow. And that's just that, and that's one of the libraries we can use. Yeah, the palette library.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm not sure where the base is, but it's a, you know, additional dependency.
Yeah, so that, if I remember right, you have like these component libraries, and then you have like the compatibility libraries. Just like how you have Recycler View as like a component, I think the palette also later on was brought in as just another component. So since we're talking about libraries, this is where it gets really interesting, right? So if you take a step back, what exactly is the role of support libraries in material design, right? I mean, why do we even bring support libraries when we talk about material design? Because at least to my knowledge, there are like 100,000 varieties of these support libraries, right? There's V7, V4, V13, design support library, app compat library. How do I make sense of all of this? Like, which one should I use? When should I use what? I mean, let's walk through this.
All right. So let's talk about what the support libraries are, because there's kind of some different variations on them, and they have different needs. So the intention of all of the support libraries is to allow Google developers to backport new functionality to older devices. So, you know, obviously there's lots of old Android phones out there that may or may not get the OS updated, but they do want to backport some of the new functionality to be able to be used on those older OSs. For instance, you know, one of the original reasons for this was the fragments. Fragments weren't originally released with the OS, and that's obviously something super important to Android developers. And the support libs allowed fragments to be used on older versions of the OS. And basically what the support libraries are they are software packages that you can add as dependencies to your project and then include, you know, that source code to be used on older versions. So there's a few different flavors of support lib, and it's worth kind of chatting about those just for a minute. There is app compat and support, and these are kind of the two. Actually, there's V4 support and V7 app compat. So those two libraries are really important and are kind of the base of what everybody should use. The one thing I kind of wanted to mention, and that if people didn't know, is the V4 and the V7 in that name stands for which version of the OS the library itself supports back to. So V4 support is a library specifically designed to provide a shim layer for all of these awesome features like fragments or the other things we mentioned so that they can work back all the way to V4 phones.
It's basically the min SDK version, right? So, I mean, that's how at least I think about it. Your min SDK? If your min SDK is 8 or 9, I really hope it's not 8 or 9, by the way. It should at least be 14 at this point, right? So if it is, then you can go all the way up to V7 and V13. And it all gives you the same functionality. It's not like V4 is like older and V7 is newer.
Right. It has nothing to do with the library age, or it has to do with the min OS support for that. And just to from the docs suggest that everybody starts with the two libraries we just discussed as the foundation, and then you start to add the rest of the support libraries, which are more compartmentalized. So you might add, like you said, the recycler view or palette library as distinct dependencies, but not as the complete package.
Right, right. That makes sense.
Is it, would you say that, is it required to use these libraries, or would you just kind of make it a very strong recommendation that you use the support libraries in this case?
So really important to talk about, and I think I would say required. So let's talk about what this means. So I mentioned that, and we're just talking about support libraries. We're not even talking about design yet. So these libraries are designed to shim the core functionality back to OSs that don't support it. So if you're on a device that supports fragments natively, the support library itself will know that you're on something that supports it natively and bypass the support lib version of that code and go right to the native version. And if you're on a OS that doesn't have the native support, it'll go to the support version. So having said that, if you use the support libs, you're confident that your code's going to work everywhere. And in the cases where it can be run with OS native, you know, because Android M supports fragments specifically, you know that you're going to be using the native code when possible, but you always have a fallback on older devices. So there's very little downside and obviously tons of upside being able to run on older versions of the code, older versions of the OS.
Obviously, I said it in jest before about like the whole 10,000 support libraries, but the support library is essentially one of the most brilliant solutions Google has come up for us to be able to push the platform forward, right, with features. It's just like, I truly think it's like one of the most amazing libraries out there. Like without the support library, it would be impossible, at least today, to sort of for developers to be happy moving forward with like the newer features that come down the pipe, right?
Yeah, and before, I know we're about to move on, but before we move on, it is worth kind of reiterating the point that you're making, that the reason these support libs exist is because this allows Google to develop these new functions and not be tied to the OS updates being done. So they're not tied to Verizon or, you know, Motorola to get these updates pushed out. So it allows them to innovate very rapidly and then allow the developer that wants to use that code base to push that code out to the to its users. It isn't relying on any sort of phone update. So it's really important because they're pushing tons and tons of innovation into both this and Play Services, those two libraries, so that they are disintermediating themselves from the OS level itself and creating all their functionality in these external libraries.
I mean, speaking about, you spoke about reliability on that side. Let's talk about the reliability for the support libraries itself. And this is just a quick point, because I know many a time we try to jump on and like quickly there to like use the support libraries. But is there like a concept of like stability for them? Because I know sometimes, I mean, these are just like libraries that Google develops, right? It's just another super smart developer there who's like building these things. But they're human in the end, right? And so what happens is sometimes things tend to break. What are your suggestions along those lines? I just want to quickly like touch on this point.
So, I mean, I think that this is kind of a good thing to talk about. I think the design libraries work really great if you're staying within the constraints that they define. So there's a few things to kind of mention with that. I think that the nature of the libraries are specifically designed to constrain you to stay within the material design specs. So certain things are very difficult to customize, because they really shouldn't be customized. Once you start changing those, then you're kind of changing the material designness. The other thing is, because these are APIs and these are libraries, they have to be limited. You know, you can't create a library that does everything for everybody, because you know it would never get out. So I think that the libraries are pretty reliable if you use them in the ways that they define them to be used. It's once you start to customize or try to go outside of the patterns that they defined, then you'll find the reliability goes down and the difficulty of customizing goes up greatly.
So my idea of having the floating action button go to random positions of your screen every time you click the button. That is not something you would recommend.
that's probably not a good pattern, especially if that's your featured action button that you you know want people to press.
Yeah. Oh, no, click here. No, now click there. Yeah.
Like the chase the monkey spam ads that we used to deal with.
So speaking of widgets, you know, of the fab and so forth, there's all kinds of things that are inside of the support library for design, various different widgets. Now, I'd like to talk about a couple of those. Like, for example, just recently, I noticed or re-noticed the coordinator layout. This one, previously to me, it seemed like it didn't really do much. It was just like this weird container layout. But a recent article by Ian Lake, which is one of the Android developer relations team representatives, after I read it, I felt a little bit differently, and I'm seeing it to be quite useful. Am I correct in this thinking? And what exactly does something like the coordinator layout do?
Okay, so the coordinator layout is kind of like your main container for kind of the new material design-ness. And what it does is it allows you to create associations between views within your container layout. So for instance, you can real simple example is the snack bar. When the snack bar is a message that comes up on the bottom of the screen, it kind of animates in, stays there for a second, and animates back down. A common pattern is if you have a fab above the snack bar, when your snack bar animates up, the fab animates up with it. And that's all because of the coordinator layout. So in the coordinator layout, we're able to create associations between different views and have the views then coordinate between each other. And the way that you do that is something called behaviors. So you create a behavior for your view, and then you can tie it to other views. In the fab instance, that behavior is included out of the box for us. And there are a bunch of other ones that are also included out of the box. So you could attach your fab to a view so that when that view scrolls, the fab scrolls with it. Or like we discussed with the snack bar, it scrolls based on other things.
I had a quick side question with respect to the coordinator layout. Does the coordinator layout add another layer? So I know Google is like pretty big on making sure that we don't have multiple nested layers of your views. Obviously, if the functionality requires it, it makes sense to add it in. But out of curiosity, is the coordinator layout basically just a wrapper that doesn't necessarily add a view to the view stack, but just like does the behaviors? Or does it actually really add another view? Does it extend like a frame layout or one of those other views? Would you know?
I think, and I'm looking this up now as we talk, I think that coordinator layout is just a frame layout.
Oh, so in that case, it does add another additional layer, I would imagine.
Yeah, but I'm honestly not sure about that.
Because I was always curious, because we have those XMLs, and now with the new Android Studio, it actually shows you the level of nesting. Adding a coordinator layer sort of makes me feel, oh, there's another layer there. Maybe I should.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, obviously, we want to keep our view hierarchies as flat as possible. So,
do you think there's any other must-use widgets that we talked about? We talked about some of the ones that we liked. Is there anything else that just comes off the top of your head that you think is super important that we should be using?
Yeah, so let's talk about, I think, one really important one is relating to navigation. So that is the nav view and the toolbar. And so these are really core navigation patterns in Android itself. And, you know, that's having a side menu that pops up and has a bunch of different buttons and the toolbar that obviously does, you know, different things. So the nav view is very difficult to customize. And again, this is one of those cases where that navigation is supposed to be very consistent and feel the same. And so you'll see lots of people complaining, you know, how do I do this in the nav view? I want to add. And the answer is you really shouldn't, but you really should be using those navigation controls to drive your app. So that drives not only the look and feel of your app, but also how your app is kind of created and how your navigation flow is designed. And again, that's really, really important to make sure that this app feels like it's designed to fit on Android. So I really think the nav view and the toolbar are kind of two core components that make your app consistent and feel like it, you know, like someone that is first coming into the app knows exactly how they're supposed to get around, exactly what they're supposed to do. And there's not a lot of customization options, only in the nav view, just the top nav view header, I think they call it. that area you can customize. But the nice thing about NavView is it's super easy to create. All of the button coloring and highlight colors that are created in the list are all done for you. All you have to do is specify a menu, just like you did with Action Bar Sherlock or any of the old action bars, and it generates all that magic for you. So really simple to use and really like dynamic and easy. So,
and for the people who are like old-time Android developers, the NavView is essentially like what you place inside your drawer layout, which is what it was called before, and toolbar is basically the action bar, right? So
those are right.
Now, are there any widgets that you would recommend not using? Like for example, I've tried to use the Fab a couple of times, but it seems like the guidance on it is like so loose. And I've also heard other developers that kind of just shy away from it. What do you advise maybe in regards to that, or just in widgets in general that you just don't advise people to use? Or is there any at all?
I think there's two. I think probably the Fab, like you mentioned, and also dialogues can have inconsistent margins. Some of the alert dialogues and some of those other ones are okay, but I had a discussion earlier this week with someone that was called out those two. I think the Fab will, like you say, jump around or be placed inconsistently, and the generic dialogues can have margins that don't appear how you'd like. So,
would you have any like parting tips for if I wanted to become like this wizard of material design like you, right? Do you have any tips on like some of the places that we can quickly touch and the different things that we should be using? Like, how do I get better at material design?
Sure. I mean, the first thing is the material design specs. They're really hippy-dippy, and they talk about a lot of really fancy and fun stuff. But everything you ever want to know about, you know, material design, their intentions, it's really well thought out. It's really well documented, and it's really clearly written. And it really kind of gives you, if you spend a little time familiarizing yourself, you really get the sense that, you know, the spec is a cohesive whole, and that they really spent a lot of time thinking about how they create, you know, this framework. So first things first, learn the specs themselves, and that has nothing to do with coding. Next steps is start to dig into these material design specs. The support libs. I did include some resources in the doc. I guess one that I want to call out is maybe a little self-serving, but I think it is super useful to the people that might be listening to this, is I created a GitHub project on GitHub called Android Historian, or
M. Wolf. Who's this guy? Okay.
My user ID is M. Wolfson. This is a project I created for the talk I gave on this subject at DroidCon New York City. And it's a project that runs all the, that implements a ton of the different support libs specifically designed to implement material design. So I include the most simple implementation of all the different components I could to create like a really simple material design app. And so it's a really useful tool, I think, because it shows you how all of this stuff comes together and actually works. And, you know, you can clone it and, you know, start from there. And I think that is a good real base material. I do want to mention that I actually forked this project from Chris Baines's T-Square project, which was his demo project for the design libs. So, you know, I forked his basic project and extended it quite a bit. And we'll continue to.
Nice. And we'll make sure we add links to all of those resources that they've given us in the show notes, and we'll link to those projects. Both Don and I believe, were in your talk for DroidCoin NYC, and it was a fantastic talk. We'll make sure we add a link to that in the show notes as well. One last point before we wind the show down is, very recently, the support library 23.2 just dropped in on us. I would really encourage, I put this on Twitter the other day, definitely watch the video, because the video is super funny. I love what the Android developer groups like Red O'Meyer and Ian Lake have been doing with their videos. Just watch the video right until the end and you'll get what I mean. But the two big things that were dropped in this library were vectors, which is always an amazing thing. Not necessarily material design related, or no, maybe it is, because we have a whole bunch of like material design icons that you can just like drop in quickly, right? So vectors was a huge thing. And there are a couple of other things. Are there anything else that you guys want to talk about with respect to 23.2?
Well, kind of there's some hidden things. So let's talk real quick about the rapid nature of the support lib iterations. They're releasing a new version of the support lib about every 2 to 3 months, and each one has like something else really big and really crazy in it. The other thing that's kind of quiet in this one that is the there's two things that are kind of interesting. They added a day-night mode, which allows you to tie into time of day on the phone and actually change your user interface for based on that. And they also have added some media router controls, which is really kind of a small thing. But what this does is this is going to allow people that use media in their apps to use these controls, and that will automatically handle pausing the sound when a phone call comes in, or all the kind of tricky things that it takes to service media on the Android phone. So I haven't dug into that yet, but for one of my clients, I really look forward to that. It'll also allow you to quickly add Android Auto controls and Android Wear controls, media controls, without kind of needing to do that yourself. So,
right.
And then one last thing is bottom sheets, which is kind of an animated view that pops up from the bottom.
That's a good one.
And it was crazy. Like, some of these features are like keynote worthy, right? Like, and they just dropped it into a support library. So, I mean, double thumbs up. Like, Google's been doing an amazing job with this. Like, the day-night mode and stuff. I can imagine, like, other companies basically, like, announcing these as features in their keynote sort of sessions, right? And, like, here we have Google just, like, dropping left and right these amazing features. So,
yeah, and I feel like this is kind of something new for us, and kind of something that we really should celebrate, because as we've all been doing Android for a long time, frequently we get really cool ideas from material design spec, and this happened, but we never had any controls. For instance, we never really had an action bar control all these years, right? They told us, you know, this is the action bar you're supposed to be using, but there never was one that was, you know, we all use obviously Action Bar Sherlock. And, you know, we finally, in fact, well, there was an action bar, but even that got replaced by toolbar. But what I'm getting at is they're finally giving us some of these really advanced controls that allow us to concentrate on the business logic and the fun stuff, and not have to go through all the work of creating native controls that match what they're asking us for. It's really awesome, and it really feels like they're making our lives so much easier.
Definitely, definitely. Mike, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I've learned already so much from this discussion.
That's great.
And I'm sure our listeners would enjoy this one as well. If people want to reach out to you, what would be the best way to do that?
Well, I guess I'm Mike Wolfson everywhere. So MikeWolfson.com, or Mike Wolfson on Twitter, or Michael Wolfson on Google+. For some reason, I couldn't do Mike there.
Okay. And can you give us your address so we can... Just kidding. Don, how do we reach you?
Just get a hold of me on Twitter at Don Felker, or my website, donfelker.com.
Perfect. And I am Kaushik Gopal at Twitter, and kaush.co is my website.
We'd like to thank our sponsor for this episode, Rollbar. With Rollbar, you get the context, insights, and control you need to find and fix bugs faster. Go to rollbar.com/fragmented and get the bootstrap plan for free for 90 days, which includes 300,000 errors tracked for free. Again, that's rollbar.com/fragmented.
Thank you all for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.
Thanks for having me, guys.
See ya.